the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, big changes are coming to Washington. We're hearing about tax reform. It could be repealing or lowering tax rates at the individual level, at the corporate level, and possibly impacting the area of estate planning. Joining us is Robert Strauss. He is a practicing attorney, and he's also a teacher of advanced estate planning at UCLA's Extension. Robert, let's begin with the repeal of estate taxes. You know, that has been brought up in the past, and the last time they talked about it, they worked out a compromise in the Obama administration, raising the exemption to $5 million, but there was a period of time when we really didn't know which way it was going. I'd like to get your take on this. What is the probability they lower estate taxes or eliminate them completely?
It's a very good question and a really challenging question to answer definitively. Here's my take on it. We find ourselves at an interesting point in time, which seems to be in many ways similar to where we found ourselves in 2001. When the second President Bush took power, and he at that point had proposed repealing the estate tax, and the Republicans had a majority in the Senate and in the House, just like they do now. In fact, Republicans had an even larger majority in the Senate at that time. I believe they had 58 seats, whereas now they have 52 seats. So it was a Republican-controlled government, and they wanted to repeal the estate tax, and what actually happened was that they couldn't get the votes to repeal the estate tax. What we've noticed, I think, all of us in the country, no matter what side of the aisle we're on, is that there's less cooperation between Republicans and Democrats now than ever before, and especially going back to 2001. And as a consequence, I think everybody who practices in the area of estate planning would recognize that if estate tax repeal would come to a vote on a standalone basis, there just aren't the votes to repeal it. There just aren't. On the other hand, most of us think that estate tax repeal would never come up on a standalone basis. It's just too small of a thing. And instead, it is far more likely to come up within the context of an overall compromise on tax reform in general, which would include corporate tax, personal tax, and so forth, which has been discussed at length in the news. The challenge is that we just can't predict how all of that's going to come out. The president has advocated reducing the corporate tax rate rather dramatically. But in order to pay for that, there would seem to be the need to raise taxes in other areas. And so we've heard, for example, that state and local tax deductions might go away, but then there's an outcry from those states that have the largest state tax rates because their constituencies would be hurt. There's a proposal to limit a charitable deduction, but there's an outcry from charities who would be dramatically impacted by that. There's a proposal to limit deductibility of home mortgage interest, and there's an outcry from the real estate industry. In other words, doing this is going to be a real challenge. When all is said and done, it's a challenge for us to give advice to our clients, but it's even more of a challenge for our clients to figure out what kind of action to take. My sense is that what will happen at the end of the day is very similar to what happened in 2001, which, as you alluded to in your introduction to this question, was an increase in the exemption amount and a decrease in the tax rate rather than a state tax repeal. So at this point, the exemption amount is $5.49 million per person. And for a married couple, that's almost $11 million, which means that those families who have assets that are worth less than $11 million today don't have to pay any estate tax. And the estate tax rate for those families who have assets that are worth more than $11 million is 40%. So there is no estate tax on the first $11 million of assets. And there's an estate tax of roughly 40% on the excess. And of course, there are all kinds of planning maneuvers that people can engage in order to mitigate the estate tax burden. But the reality is it impacts very few people. And if the kind of reform that we think will happen actually does happen, it would impact even fewer people, as opposed to complete repeal.
I want to move on to some other areas of estate planning, because I'm in agreement with you that there just doesn't seem to be the votes and the negative publicity of, you know, giveaways to the rich. But there was a compromise, just like in the second Bush term, where they actually raised the exemption. So looking at other areas of estate planning, I want to begin with, you have couples that get married later on in life, and let's say they don't have children. Is that more challenging from an estate planning perspective because you don't have heirs? I know we see a lot of clients that will name children as successor trustees or guardians, or they grant them the durable powers of attorney. What happens, or how do you plan for a couple that has no children?
That's a really good question. I don't think that it's necessarily intellectually more challenging, although it certainly could be emotionally more challenging. Where a married couple does have children, the natural thing for them to do, of course, is to leave their assets to their children. When they don't have children, they have to step back and think about who should receive our assets. And what we've experienced over the course of time is that couples in that situation tend to leave their assets to other family members, like their siblings or their nieces and nephews. They tend to leave their assets to close personal friends, and they tend to leave their assets to the charities that they've been supporting during their lifetime. It's just a little bit harder because they have to think through more particularly who should get these assets, rather than, you know, parents with children, where it's a knee-jerk reaction. It's an appropriate reaction, but it's just so easy to say, yeah, of course I want my kids to get it. From a documentation perspective, it's not any more difficult. It's just, how do you help the client to understand what the choices are? And then psychologically and emotionally, how does the client get comfortable making those choices?
Another question that comes up, and, you know, I've always been a big proponent of trust for avoidance of probate, for the saving of estate taxes, for handling disability, incapacity issues. But I've also found with clients, as we have clients around the country, there's different views on probate. Some attorneys, and I found this more on the East Coast, think probate is not a big deal. I wonder if you can address probate, what it is, some of the issues involved with it, for example, time delays and fees. In your opinion, why the difference of sometimes attorneys looking at it and saying it's really not a big deal?
Well, estate planning is a very interesting area of the law in the sense that it calls into question both federal law, which is the estate tax, and state law, which are the documents that we prepare. So while we're working on estate planning and dealing with estate tax at the federal level, we do so through the use of documentation that's governed by state law. In California, we have a probate, and the way to avoid a probate is to use a living trust. By using a living trust and having one's assets owned by the living trust, we create the fiction that the owner of the assets, which would be the living trust, did not die when the individual died. The reason that we want to avoid a probate in California is because it's especially expensive in California. Whereas in some other states, in particular on the East Coast, the cost of a probate is so much less. So for example, in California, $1 million of assets would give rise to a probate fee of $22,400. That is really rather expensive. And the fee just goes up from there based upon the size of the estate. It's a lot to avoid. But in other states, there isn't a lot to avoid. And so there's less reason to insist upon a plan that overall avoids that fee.
What about some of the issues, though, Robert? Let's say the wife is the survivor. She passes on. The estate goes into probate. So let's say maybe there's not heavy fees, depending on the estate that you're in. What about the delays or the fact that the estate is frozen? For example, if I'm an investment advisor to an individual, that individual passes away and their estate goes into probate, I just can't willy-nilly go on carrying managing money for the heirs, whoever they may end up being, if the estate is in probate. What about some of those other issues?
Well, those issues certainly exist. And, you know, we spend most of our time guiding clients through a process that results in the creation of a revocable living trust precisely because we want to avoid the adverse consequences of a probate. And the fees that I mentioned are just one of those adverse consequences. The delay imposed by a probate court certainly is another. And during that delay, the inability to have complete control over one's affairs can be a real problem. For example, if a probate estate owned an asset that was about to be negatively, adversely affected in value, a stock in a publicly traded company that just received very, very bad news, and you want to sell it before the value plummets, if the estate is going through a probate, you literally would have to petition the court for permission to sell that asset. And although every state, I believe, has a mechanism for an emergency hearing, you nevertheless have to go through that mechanism with a minimum of at least one day of notice, if not more. And that could make all the difference in the world. The market can move very quickly in a one-day period. And so that puts the estate at a tremendous disadvantage.
Yeah, because what comes to mind is the bear markets that we had between 2000 and 2002, where the S&P lost over 50%, and even worse, the bear market of 2007 to 2009, when the S&P lost almost 60%. So imagine you have assets in the stock market and you're trying to protect it for the heirs, but you have to get the permission of court to do anything.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, I remember anecdotally going to lunch on a day during the 2007-2008 crash and watching the stock market on the television screen that was in the deli where I was having lunch. And the stock market during that 1 hour fell 600 points, which is crazy and tumultuous. And if one is burdened with a probate and needs to react quickly, one could lose a lot of value. So it's certainly another reason. And the third reason has to do with the public nature of a court proceeding. Probate is public. Documents that are filed with the court are, for the most part, available for anybody to see. So maybe the average person doesn't care so much if the public has access to their private information, their personal information, their financial information. But a lot of people do care about that. A lot of people, rightly so, are intensely private and don't want to expose all of those kinds of things to the world and should, therefore, try very hard to avoid a probate, which is easy to avoid with a revocable living trust.
You know what always amazed me, and when I first got in the business, we read about these very famous cases of movie stars from Groucho Marx to well-known celebrities, Ed McMahon, and a lot of people that we know as public figures, either on television or in the movies, did nothing on their estate planning. So therefore, their entire estate, all the squabbles, all the dirt about family members contesting, all of that became public record. I'm really surprised, and has it surprised you in your practice, that a lot of times very famous people, people that have tremendous wealth and also are just famous in who they are, because movie stars try to be private because they don't get very much privacy, that they don't do anything in their estate planning. Have you found that to be common? I mean, we hear about all this stuff from the rock star Prince, who was worth close to, what, $300 million? You hear it from rock stars, movie stars, to very big athletes.
Prince is only the most recent example. I would like to tell you that I'm surprised. But I can't be surprised because it happens over and over and over again. And if I continue to be surprised, then I'm really just being ignorant and foolish. It's very common, and there are all kinds of reasons for it. I think one of the reasons is that it's difficult for any person, whether a celebrity or not, to want to confront their own mortality. And for sure, when going through an estate planning process that results in creating a revocable living trust and other estate planning documents, foremost on one's mind is one's mortality, right? Because we're dealing with what happens when I die. My own father didn't want to confront those issues for years and years, and he was a Harvard-trained lawyer. He was a brilliant man, and emotionally and psychologically, he just wasn't prepared to deal with it until he was. And thankfully, he dealt with it far in advance of his own death. But I see it all over the place. Beyond that, I think that lots of folks who should be receiving good estate planning advice just don't. They don't for one reason or another, which are hard to predict and understand, but I think the simplest explanation is that they're receiving advice from people who are professionals in their own disciplines and focus on the knowledge that they have in their own fields and don't go any further than that. So, for example, an accountant may be giving income tax advice to a wealthy person or to a celebrity or to a regular person, but may never bring up estate planning. I think accountants should. I think lawyers should. I think think financial advisors should. I think financial planners should, but it doesn't always happen. And even when it does happen, the client may be reluctant to follow through for one reason or another.
I know, even in our own practice, and we've been doing this for well over three decades, when you're doing a financial plan, people get excited about retirement, about returns in their portfolio, or lowering their taxes. Those are things that they can see immediately. When you start talking about estate planning, it's really talking about something after you're gone, so you don't see the benefits. And I have found, of all the areas that we approach in planning, that is where we find the most reluctance on individuals wanting to do something. You know, do I really have to spend this kind of money to get a trust? Do I really have to spend this money to see the attorney? Can we postpone, or can we put that off at another time? Because as you mentioned, Robert, they don't want to talk about. You don't sit around the dinner table, hey, let's talk about what happens when we're gone.
That is so true. And maybe from my own narrow professional perspective, the best way of conveying that idea is that I almost never receive an estate planning client at a party. Although I receive plenty of questions about estate planning that. Rather, I receive an estate planning client from some other important advisor to the client who has been giving that client advice for a long period of time. You need to do your estate plan. And the client eventually, for one reason or another, is ready to do it. It may take a year, it may take 10 years. Eventually, they're ready to do it. But until they're ready, they're not going to do it, which is a shame. It's a shame because they're at risk all that time.
You know, and especially I find this with the younger couples. And unfortunately now, with some of these technology companies, I mean, look at Mark Zuckerberg. What is he, barely 31 or 32, and he's worth $59 billion. One can assume that Mark has probably done some planning. But you do have a lot of people that work at Facebook, that have worked at Google, very young people in their 30s who have amassed tremendous wealth through stock options, and they don't think about this. And it's like, hey, I'm in my 30s. I don't need to talk about this. Now I'm going to live another 40, 50 years. We'll talk about it then. I want to talk about three kind of cases. Let's talk about a newlywed. You have a millennial couple. They're out of college. They just started their working career. Maybe they're thinking of starting a family. Let's talk about some basic things. What should that type of individual do, or a couple be doing, from an estate planning point of view? A will, durable powers of attorney. What kind of documents would be appropriate in most cases for a couple starting out?
Well, even a couple who has no assets should be preparing financial powers of attorney, and should be preparing health care documents where they designate their spouse, for example, to make health care decisions for them if they are otherwise unable to make health care decisions. But almost everybody has some amount of assets, even if it's $10,000 in a bank account, whatever it happens to be. At a minimum, they should have a will that designates their spouse as beneficiary, at a minimum, just in order to avoid probate and in order to avoid the craziness that might arise in the absence of a document where broader family would, for one reason or another, assert, hey, she intended to leave those assets to me, not to her husband. But where there are just a little bit more in assets, maybe a few hundred thousand dollars worth of assets, they really should be doing a basic living trust in order to avoid a probate, where the spouse is designated as the beneficiary, and if the spouse doesn't survive, then the people who are important to them in their lives, whether it's other family members, whether it's friends, or whether it's charities, ought to be designated as the remainder contingent beneficiaries. And even for newlyweds who are just getting started in life, it would be wise to do this. You're probably going to take me next to a scenario where a couple has a young child. And a friend of mine once told me this little story. He said to me, I remember when our first child was born and we didn't go out on a date night for maybe 6 months while we were taking care of our child, but then it was time to get out of the house, and we needed to get out of the house. In order to do that, we needed to bring in a babysitter. So we brought in a babysitter, and we gave the babysitter 2.5 pages of instructions. You know, the phone numbers where we were going to be and when to feed and when to put her down and all the kinds of instructions that the babysitter would need to take care of our newborn child while we were just going to dinner and a movie. Wouldn't you want to do the same thing at least, if not more, if you were dead? And that's what an estate plan can do.
I want to take another situation. Okay, so we've got the couple. They get married. Now, let's fast forward 10, 15, 20 years. Same couple. They have children now, maybe two children. Maybe they're teenagers, maybe older. And also, the couple has begun to amass assets, you know, either retirement assets and a 401k, the equity and the value of their house, where now we have substantial assets that are starting to accumulate. Let's talk about what should be done there, because it would strike me something like a trust would be very important for the protection of the children, for the surviving spouse, and also, depending on the size of the assets, when you start accumulating assets, and especially we see this in California. I mean, the definition of a millionaire in California is a homeowner. So, you know, when you talk about $1 million, you can see that easily in some of the equity that people have in their homes here. And if you go up north, Robert, as you know, into Silicon Valley, where you have all these tech startups and the big companies that we all see in the stock market traded each day, there is a tremendous amount of wealth. In fact, so much wealth that California gets 20% of its tax revenues from capital gains. So what do you do when you're that kind of a couple?
Well, when you're that kind of a couple, you really need to get serious about estate planning. And I think that it happens at a minimum at least two levels. The first level is what happens when the first spouse dies. And in California, the assets are all community property, which means literally half the assets belong to one spouse and the other half of the assets belong to the other spouse. Of course, there could be some separate property as well, but let's just assume that the married couple, when they got married, had nothing and they accumulated these assets while they were married. So the first spouse to die, the deceased spouse, probably wants the surviving spouse to have access to all the assets. But in California, where the divorce rate is so high, where remarriage happens all the time, would it make sense for the surviving spouse to inherit from the deceased spouse's entire share of the estate, outright and free of trust, which would enable the surviving spouse, in theory, to leave the deceased spouse's share of the estate to a new husband or to a new wife or to a new set of children from a second marriage or from a third marriage? Sometimes the answer is yes. Both couples very much want the surviving spouse to have complete and unrestricted flexibility to do whatever she or he wants to do with all of those assets. What I found, however, in my practice is that most of the time the answer is yes, but. Yes, for sure, I want the surviving spouse to have access to all these assets. We're married. We love each other. God forbid one of us dies. For sure, the surviving spouse should have access to these assets. But I also, at the same time, want to be sure that when the surviving spouse dies, my share of the estate, which my spouse enjoyed while she was alive, my share of the estate for sure goes to our children, the children for whom I am the father. And that can be accomplished through the creation of sub-trusts within the living trust, called an exemption trust or a bypass trust on the one hand, and a marital trust or a Q-tip trust on the other hand. And without getting too complicated, these trusts would allow the surviving spouse to have access to the income and to the principal of the deceased spouse's share of the estate if she needs it or if he needs it for health, education, support, and maintenance, which is a normal standard, or upon any other standard that's legal and that makes sense, such that when the surviving spouse eventually dies, the assets remaining in those sub-trusts would automatically pass to my children so that I'm not at risk for my spouse remarrying and giving my share of the estate to a new spouse or to a new set of kids. So that's the first level. And it's pretty common for spouses to think that through and to agree with each other that that makes sense, because each spouse wants to be protected in that way. And in fact, each spouse wants to be protected in both of those ways, meaning that each spouse wants access to the assets of the deceased spouse, and each spouse would want his or her share of the estate to go to his kids when the surviving spouse eventually dies. So that's the first level. Then the second level is, if both spouses are gone, what happens with respect to the kids? And just think about a scenario where, God forbid, both spouses die when the kids are young. We wouldn't want those young children to have immediate and instant access to significant wealth because they're just simply not mature enough, whether psychologically, financially, or otherwise, to handle the access to that kind of wealth. I remember when I was a child, one of my friend's fathers bought a Corvette, and my friend, he was 15 at the time, grabbed the keys. Of course, he didn't have a license. He was underage, but he grabbed the keys and he took the car out and he wrapped the car around a tree. And I have that vision in my mind sort of as a metaphor for what happens if kids at too young of an age get access to significant wealth. And so what we see in a revocable living trust is the parents providing protection for the kids, protection from the kids themselves by leaving the assets in a trust for some period of time. At a minimum, until they think the children are going to be old enough to manage their own financial affairs. And they put another person that they trust completely in charge of the trust for the child. And they give this other person, who may be a sibling of the parents, or maybe a best friend, or maybe a close advisor, or it may even be a financial institution operating as a trust company, the discretion to use the assets of the trust for the benefit of the child. To ensure that the child has money needed for health, for education, for support, for maintenance. And if the right trustee is selected, the idea is that the selected trustee is going to do for the children what the parents would have done for the children if the parents were still around. And that's the kind of person or institution that the parents should be looking for to take care of the children. So, for example, in a very simple format, it might be the case that if both parents were gone, they would say that we want our assets to go in equal shares to our children, and we want our assets to be held in trust for our children, where the trustee has the discretion to use the income and the principal of the trust to take care of the children. And when the child reaches age 25, we'll distribute one-third of the trust assets to the child, not the whole thing, just a third. When the child reaches age 30, we'll distribute the second third to the child. And when the child reaches age 35, we'll distribute the final third to the child. And it doesn't have to be three shares at ages 25, 30, and 35. And it doesn't have to be those ages. And it doesn't even have to be ever. But the philosophy underlying that concept is maybe by the time the child reaches age 25, the child's going to be mature enough to handle a portion of it. But in case we're wrong, we're not giving the child all of it. We're protecting the child from the rest. And in between ages 25 and 30, the child will acquire more wisdom, more experience, and may be better able to handle financial affairs without making poor choices and poor decisions. But we're still not gambling all of it at the second tranche, and we're waiting for the third age to make a complete distribution. But again, it doesn't have to be three. It could be one. It could be six. It could be any number. It doesn't have to be those ages. They don't have to be spaced out in 5 years. And there definitely are circumstances under which my clients elect to never force a distribution to the child, but instead provide that the children will be equal beneficiaries, but in trust, where somebody is going to be the trustee for the child until the child is mature enough to handle his or her own financial affairs, at which point the child will become his or her own trustee. And the philosophy there is that if the assets remain in trust, the child might enjoy some degree of divorce protection because those assets are clearly the child's separate property. And it would be really hard for a divorcing spouse of the child to claim an ownership interest in trust assets. It should be impossible. And the child would also enjoy some degree of creditor protection because if somebody sues the child for a bad deed that the child committed, it ought to be very hard for the person suing the child to reach into that trust, take the assets inside of that trust. Although if there's a distribution from the trust to the child, maybe the person suing the child could go after the distribution. So there's divorce protection, some, and there's creditor protection, some. And in larger estates, there's also the concept of estate tax protection in the sense that a certain amount of the assets belonging to the parents can be set aside in trust for the benefit of the children. And when the children die a generation later, the assets set aside for the benefit of the children won't be subject to estate tax in the children's own estate and will then pass to grandchildren free of a second layer of estate tax. This is only applicable for larger estates, but it is important for those who have larger estates to think about.
A final question, if I may, Robert. How often should individuals update their estate plan? We all know that every single year we have to file our tax return. That's a requirement by law. We all know from a health perspective, it's a good idea to get a physical each year and see our doctor. When it comes to estate planning, it strikes me there's a number of things that can change. Number one, wealth can change, either expanded as in this bull market with the stock market hitting records, or decline in the case of, let's say, a bear market like we saw in 2007 and 2009. So there's the issue of wealth, either increase or decrease. Secondly, there's family issues, the birth of children, a divorce, maybe a special needs child, or maybe even health issues itself. How often should one update the estate plan? And maybe I'm thinking of a third one as we begin our discussion today, the idea that Congress may change the laws.
Well, you're very astute. I think those are the three principal drivers for the need to review and rethink an estate plan: the family, the wealth, and the tax law. And what I recommend clients do is look at their documents at least once a year. Maybe they can get it into their heads that when they're filing their personal income tax returns, they can just pull out their documents for the summary of their documents and think through whether anything has changed so that it might make sense to have a conversation with their estate planning attorney or with their other financial planning advisors. So I encourage my clients to do that. And what I say to my clients is, if you have a notion in your mind that as a consequence of a change in one of those three areas, it might be necessary for you to make a change to your documents, give me a call and we'll talk about it for a minute or two and we'll quickly decide whether or not it's worth a longer discussion. Here's a great example. I had clients call me just a couple of days ago. Today's Thursday, so it was Monday, just a couple of days ago, to ask me, hey, do we need to update our estate plan because we just gave birth to our third child? And is our third child included in our living trust? And so the answer is, their living trust leaves their assets to all of their children, whether or not their children are designated by name. And so without adding the third child's name to the living trust, the third child is automatically included. So in that regard, they don't have to make a change. But it's been my experience over the course of time that when a family has a new child, they do want to make an elective change just to add the name of the new child so that in case, God forbid, they should die, they don't want their new child to feel left out or unthought of. So that's an example of an optional change that many clients elect to make simply for emotional reasons.
Well, good, sound advice. Well, listen, Robert, as we close, if our listeners would like to contact you or follow the things that you do, tell them how they could do so, please.
Of course. My telephone number is 310-553-8844. I'm a partner at a firm called Weinstock Mannion, which is in Century City in Los Angeles. Our website is weinstocklaw.com, which is spelled weinstocklaw.com. We're a firm of 17 attorneys, all practicing in the area of estate planning, and we're good people because we care about our clients and we like to help them, and we would be delighted to answer questions.
Well, listen, Robert, I want to thank you for joining us on the program. Some great advice, and all the best to you, sir.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
You know, I want to end this discussion on perhaps the last question I asked Robert, and that is, when do you update your estate plan? Or if you don't have one, you may want to consider it. Because I don't care what age you are. You could be young. You could be a young couple starting out. Maybe you're in your mid-40s or 50s. Whatever it is, you should have some kind of an estate plan, whether it's a will, durable powers of attorney. If you have assets here in California, remember, as Robert talked about, you know, it's over $22,000 in freezing of the estate on $1 million. So it can add up rather quickly. The important thing, just like you get an annual physical, it's very important that you also have an estate plan review. I'm Jim Poplava. Thanks for listening.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.